This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Spalding Gray, has chronicled his life in a series of comic autobiographical monologues. His latest, Gray's Anatomy, begins about the time he turned 50, when he started losing the vision in his left eye. His doctor recommended surgery, but before checking into a hospital, Gray decided to see if alternative medicine had anything to offer. Gray's Anatomy, which has been published as a paperback book, describes Gray's adventures on the fringes of alternative medicine as he tries nutritional ophthalmology, psychic surgery, and a sweat lodge. P.S. He finally had the surgery. Gray didn't have much experience with doctors as a child because his mother was a Christian Scientist. I asked him to describe the problem with his eye.
I just noticed that when I was reading over my manuscript of my novel, Impossible Vacation, that the page, the print was breaking down, like getting kind of disintegrating or rotting like Swiss cheese. And it bothered me so much, I began testing my eyes where I'd cover one eye, and I noticed that in my left eye, I could really not get in any of it really in sharp focus. And was really troubled by that because I could hold it as close to my eye as possible in a way. So I thought, oh boy, this hasn't got to do with glasses, and I really just put it off until I finished the book. I mean, it was probably 6 months before I just went for a routine eye exam.
When I think there's something wrong, I usually like call the doctor immediately, and get the earliest appointment possible.
Good for you.
Well, it's because I'm paranoid. I always think, like, if I wait, it's really going to get bad. Uh-huh. How did you manage to put it off for so long without worrying yourself to death?
It's funny. I think that I probably am so worried about so many different things that I just thought, well, the saying paranoid, and here I am at the Christian Science Monitor being an ex-Christian Scientist, also that plays into it. But if you say you're paranoid, you also say paranoids have things to be paranoid about. But if you're paranoid, it's selecting that thing. So it's like, I thought, well, this is just one of many things that might be bothering me now, and I'll eventually get to the doctor. But also because I was working on the book and was so determined to finish it, and I tell you, that book really took its toll on me because I now have arthritis in my right hand because I wrote it over a 6-year period and it was 1900, you know, hand type pages, but written that would be twice as much. And so now my right knuckle and thumb are pretty crippled from holding the pen with that terrific power and strength. So now I can't write anymore. I'm saved. I just have to talk. I can't write. I can write poetry and that's about it.
Does this make you regret doing the book?
No, I just didn't know a book could injure me in that kind of way because I still am convinced that it did this to my left eye, you know.
Right.
There's two parts of me, which I try to talk about in the monologue. There's the one that, I think there's a Thomas Pynchon quote that I lifted for one of the only play that I ever wrote for a character in a collection called Orchards. And it says this paranoia and then this anti-paranoia, which is much more frightening because you simply cannot get a hold of anything to be afraid of. And that in the monologue is represented by my doctor saying to me, the specialist, he says, this condition is idiopathic, meaning no known cause. So then you're really floating out there because you haven't got anything to hitch on to and you're just saying, we don't know what this is, so we're going to have to go through with the operation. Whereas the other part of me was sure that it had to have some sort of cause. And I did, you know, blame it on the novel and got into this kind of Jungian interpretive thing where you can say left eye represents the female aspect, the dark shadow side, the mother side. I went blind because I was I had a blind spot about my mother's whatever, and I could fill in the blanks there, her madness, her dark side. You know, you could just run with that, and I could still do that. I could still analyze that to the nth degree. That didn't bring back my sight.
Your doctor recommended surgery, but you wanted to try alternative
but
therapies.
But my doctor said the doctor I went to see, the second one, said there's no rush on this because I had a condition called macula pucker, and there are macula puckers that do 1%, whatever that means, clear up on its own. And I actually met someone who had that happen. So always you're thinking, well, maybe, of course I'm going to wait because I may be the one percentile. And all they do is tell you to wait. They don't say there's any diet involved or cutting back on drinking, although I did stop drinking because I was very worried about affecting my, you know, eyesight in any way during that time. And so what I was entering into is trying to enter into a state of healthy consciousness where I would try alternatives. And what happened was that there are so many out there. And they are done in such a fundamentalist kind of you know, we have the answer way, that I was bouncing from alternative. I never found the one, and I didn't, because of my kind of reporter temperament anyway, since a part of me was the person doing research, the monologist, I said, well, let's check out another one. And I could never find one that I could really sit with, and I finally gravitated back, as I probably somewhere knew in me that I would, to this doctor. And seeing Richard Nixon, actually, in his office, put me over the edge in a funny sort of way.
Right, you thought you were hallucinating, but Richard Nixon really walked into his office.
Well, I thought the man had a mask on at first. I thought it was a Nixon mask. And you know, you've read the book. It's published by Vintage. And it's just a sign of the times. Vintage, the lawyers at Vintage are so, talk about being paranoid, wanting to change all the situations in the book and all the people's names. And they actually wanted to take out the Nixon story. Which is beyond me. You know, I don't understand it. Public figure now deceased.
You say in your book that what you wanted was magic. You didn't want surgery. You wanted some kind of magical cure that would just heal you and fix it. Did you believe that that was possible?
There's a part of me that does. When I talk of parts, I do feel that I'm still not whole. Not a whole. No, I'm operating from many different areas, and sometimes it's the illusion of wholeness when I'm looking in a mirror, but mostly not. And so there was the part that, and I was going to say now the Christian Scientist part, but I don't think that it's just as simple as Christian Science. I think that all of us have this baby or magical child in us, the magical thinking that goes on that we never really leave. And I was reminded of that when I was here. I'm here in Washington, D.C. now, and I saw a road production of the Angels in America. And it was part one, and what an epic piece. And, of course, the angel is threatening to come all the time. We have all sorts of fluttering of wings, and then it appears at the end, and I was chilled. Now, I haven't experienced a chill like that in the theater that I can remember. And I realized at that point, it went through the audience, too. I'm sure it was in the audience. It was a whole big chill. And I know that that came from, and I would even include Karl Marx in this, that all of us have a great unconscious, sometimes getting more conscious, need for divine intervention.
Let's talk about some of, or at least one of the people who you went to hoping that they could heal you. I mean, one of the people was a nutritional ophthalmologist.
No, that's a funny man, because I changed the names, although I kept the fact that it was a configuration of two brothers and an 89-year-old mother. And they did have bottle-thick glasses, and they were in New Jersey. And I changed them to Nutley, which seemed like an appropriate town for them from the original one that were in. And then I changed their names because for the book and also for the show, actually, because I was advised to do that. Now, I got a call from him, from the doctor, and he left, please call me back on my machine. And I kept avoiding him because I was sure he was going to try to sue me. And he finally got a hold of me and he said, we found out that you're telling a story about us at Lincoln Center, and my mother and brother and I all want tickets because we can't wait to see it. And I thought, oh my God, I got to put this off until the last show, because it's just, they're not going to receive this well the way I depict them, which it's pretty nutty. And they are pretty nutty. And so they came the last night. And before they came, because one of the brothers was an opera singer, sang for the Metropolitan Opera, the assistant, and I tell about that in the monologue, his brother, who's the doctor, requested that the ex-opera singer brother get up on stage and do an aria after my monologue at Lincoln Center at the Beaumont. And I immediately said, we'd have union problems. So he said, is there a way we could have a spotlight on him and he'd stand in his seat? And I said, no, I'm afraid we can't do that. They did come. I did the show. It was very difficult to get through it because I was very, very conscious about that section. I thought I was going to stutter when I got to it. Afterwards, they were there with their mother. They drove in from New Jersey. She's 91 now. She's still skiing. She cross-country skis now, not downhill, at 91. And they were waiting with their cameras and autograph books. They thought it was superb. And a week later, I got a notarized letter from him saying, please change our name and address back to the actual name and address. And I didn't do it. But they was notarized saying, we give you permission to tell the truth.
That's great. What did the nutritional ophthalmologist tell you that you should do to heal your eye?
Well, mainly what he wanted to start with was a complete regime of health, you know, that was for the whole body, because the eye is just, you know, one window to the soul, one portion of the body, and of course it's being affected by the whole condition. So it was a raw vegetable diet was mainly it, and all coffee, alcohol, tobacco, any kind of stimulants, any kind of that traditional lovely pleasurable poisons had to go.
So how has your life changed by having to eat only raw vegetables and not any other, not cooked foods, not chicken, fish, no coffee, no cigarettes. Well, you don't smoke anyways, no alcohol.
Well, the way that it changed was that, I'll do this as an experiment, you know, and what it did was cause enormous intestinal gas. That's one way that it changed, you know, and I just had to be very selective about who I was around. It had to be people that really loved and accepted me, and that was minimal. And boring, you know, not interested in going shopping, not looking forward to mealtimes, but also a lightness, you know, it added to a kind of lightness of consciousness, just a more like you're about to be blown away in the wind, or by your own wind, for that matter.
My guest is Spalding Gray. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Spalding Gray, his latest monologue, Gray's Anatomy, which is also published in book form, is about his adventures on the fringes of alternative medicine, looking for a cure so he could avoid undergoing surgery to save the sight in his left eye. So you went to see a Filipino psychic surgeon. What is the principle they use? What do they tell you about what they're doing?
What they don't tell you, but this psychic surgeon apparently appeared to be putting his hands right into people's flesh and pulling out huge balls of meat that were supposed to be cancers. But when you're there observing it, you really fall into it. You don't question it. You really, it's like a mass hypnosis. Now, I have to say, I didn't trust him because of his theatrics and the way his cancer balls started to look like the same calf hearts or livers coming out, you know, chicken liver, kind of, you know, same. I didn't know what cancer looked like, but it had the same kind of consistency each day. So what I did was I was in a small hill town, the Philippines, and I asked different people if they knew of any authentic healers that hadn't been, quote, discovered yet. And I was told it was one named Paul up in the hills, or biblical for me, and I went up there, and he was just in a small grass hut. His wife had two small children, and it was a dirt floor. His wife said he wasn't there today. He was out doing healings in the villages for nothing, you know, and his social work. Now, I thought, this man is probably the real thing. This man is a real psychic surgeon who's not going to rip me off. And he came to my hotel with his 2-year-old son, and immediately I thought, oh, family man, he's so honest looking. And I said, will you come to my hotel room and operate on me? Because with the other psychic surgeon, you had to be there in a huge group, and it was all Japanese that didn't speak any English, and the blood was flying everywhere. I describe it in the book. It's incredible. This man would come to my room and give me an operation. It was for $50 each time he touched me. And he went up my body. I lay naked on my hotel bed. And he, every time he tweaked my body with his hands, blood would come out. But not spraying like the other one. Just little patches of fresh blood. Until he got up to my left eye, which was the problem. And he pulled out what looked like, I would say, something the size of a shrimp embryo. And threw it into a glass of water with all the other gauze. So this water was... this glass had some water in it, but mainly my blood, supposedly. Now, after he did this a couple of times to me, I said to him, show me how you make the blood come. And he said, I am not a magician. I'm a healer. And I said, well, I'm going to take the blood. And I took the glass, and he chased me into my kitchen. He said, you can't have that. It's polluted. And I said, no, it's my blood. I'm taking it with me back to America.
But you wanted to check to see if it was your blood or not?
Yeah. And so I poured it into a plastic water bottle, not sterilized, and put it up high on a shelf. He still wanted it back. I wouldn't give it to him. I sat down with my notebook, and I asked him how to spell his last name, which was a mistake. And he said, are you here to write or get healed? Because if you're here to write, and this is the old story, isn't it? If you ask too many questions, you're not going to get healed kind of thing. If you're here to write about this, you're not going to be healed. And I ended up liking him even more. The more he scolded me, and I chased him down to his summer retreat house, which was another little shack on the China Sea, and some cab drivers took me for the 20-minute, you know, everything is 20 minutes, but it wasn't. It was two drivers driving for an hour and a half. And he did some more operations on me down there. I really invested in this man and got to the point where I put full faith in him. got the blood back to San Francisco, and I was doing a benefit for George Coates Performix Works, and I said, in exchange for the benefit, you take this to a forensic lab, have an assistant do it, and get it analyzed. And because everyone was sure it couldn't be analyzed because it hadn't been refrigerated, and it wasn't, hygienic in any way. But this forensic lab evidently was able to, because I was down in San Antonio and I got a fax saying, your blood has been analyzed. It's bovine. You have the blood of a cow.
Do you see, I always figure, well, there is such a thing as the placebo effect. And darn it, yeah. I'm going to have that work for me as much as it can. So well, I always figure, like, to the extent that I can believe in something, I'm going to believe in it, because right. at the very least, it's going to help that placebo effect kick in, and I want it.
Can't do it. As long as you're involved in dialectical thinking, and you cannot not be in that, because you get back to the old Freudian statement of every statement implies its, or way before Freud, take it back to Plato, but every statement implies its opposite, so that you're immediately thinking of the opposite. It's the old thing of how do you turn a pot of water into gold if you could stir it without thinking of elephants, what's the first thing you think of? And so I don't understand how one, I can see, I don't understand what, how one would have faith. I don't know what that is about. I think it must be a magnificent thing. I don't think I will know it in my lifetime. I did have, though, an incident that I still can't explain happened to me in Santa Cruz, and I think it came from being out in California too long, and I'm trying to stay away from California, and I've done it by coming to Washington, D.C., which is the other country. And I had taken some psilocybin mushrooms with a couple of men and gone down into a redwood forest. Now, it was not a heavy dose. There was not a lot of hallucination going on. There was a lot of camaraderie, a kind of grooving on nature. And we had been down there a number of hours, so it was losing its effect. And I would say that I was approaching sobriety. Not that that can even exist in California. I mean, you just go from one state into another state of magical thinking, in my opinion. At least when I'm out there, I'm stimulated to do that. So we're coming out of the redwoods, and we're in a field, and it's beautiful. 400 or 500 acres up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, looking over the Pacific Ocean, and it's just become dark. And coming up the coast is this suspended, flashing, triangular, hovering thing, craft. And I stop and turn in my tracks and go, wow, wait a minute, guys, look, what is that? And they both turned to me as though they'd rehearsed this thing and say, oh, they always come around Santa Cruz at sundown, you know, and if you're really quiet, one will land. I said, what do you mean one will land? The spaceships that land in Santa Cruz. You're kidding. I went, oh, I see another one. And I got down on my knees, Terry, and I said, please land. And later they told me that it was airplanes coming up from Monterey. And they come straight up, and then they turn east over Santa Cruz. So they really are coming straight up the coast. And you're seeing them as though they're hovering right over the trees. But they're really in a kind of steady line coming up, so you're seeing their front lights. Now, I didn't know who I was at that moment. And they were apologetic for putting me on. And I was so happy that I was able to be put on. I thought there was this true believing child in me that I thought was completely gone, one without irony, this very innocent being.
So you finally got surgery for your eye.
Yeah.
What was the outcome?
The outcome was that he was very conservative in his promises, but the outcome was that I was had a 2200 acuity. Now, those are just numbers. I'm sure they mean nothing to you. They would mean something to you if they could hold up a lens over your eye to make that acuity, and then you'd say, oh, yeah, that's 2200. So I was not seeing very well, and after the operation, it came down to 2070. Now, that is a big difference, but it's not a big difference when your eye has been bandaged for 2 weeks and you don't have the memory, you don't have the visual memory of the 2200. So you still haven't got perfect eyesight in your left eye. And you're thinking, that's what I want back. And there's this other voice saying, this something has changed in you physically that will never be the same again. And so that was a first real sense of old age and mortality in a very real way. And so I now have a kind of ghost floating in the middle of my eye where I'm right-eyed, and I'm praying every day to my right eye. I mean, I give thanks for the right-eyed vision. It's relatively clear.
Okay, when you say you're praying for your right eye, I want to know how literally you mean that.
Well, when I pray, I appreciate. I appreciate in the face of when I say get discouraged and start complaining, and I say I still have my vision. And mainly what does that, and when I say prayer, it's an appreciation that comes when I see and have enormous now feeling for and relationship to blind people in any situation, mainly on the streets when I see them. And most recently, I've taken up downhill skiing. And has been enormously powerful event for me. In fact, I've been working on a new piece about that, which I'm testing out in Martha's Vineyard this summer, a new monologue on learning to ski at 53. And my fantasy is to teach blind people to downhill ski. I mean, that's my fantasy of what I want to do in old age.
So when you talk about praying for your right eye, you're talking about
giving thanks.
Giving thanks.
Yeah.
To?
That just goes out. Just goes out, oh, wow, thanks, oh, my God. You know, I'm saying God all the time, so I must, as the Philippine waiter said, you're praying all the time, sir. I said, what do you mean I'm praying? You're saying, oh, my God, another beer, oh, my God, I'm a God. And if I do cry out to God, and I do it, it's when I'm skiing, and I come to the edge of a cliff and look out over that landscape and go, oh, my God, I don't think I've ever said it so many times. So I kind of equate that with skiing and blindness.
You know, in your monologue in Grey's Anatomy, you say that somebody told you that you were living through the Bermuda Triangle of health.
Mm-hmm.
What is that, and do you think you're there?
I thought it was one of those nice little kind of superstitious joke phrases. It was Renee's mother that said it, and it was like, you know, it's nice to think that such a thing exists because you like to think that once you get past, and I am 54 now, so I'm past it, that it's a clearer sailing, but it's you know, it certainly is not. I now have a torn meniscus in my left knee, the cartilage of my knee, that I tore on the way to go skiing, not even skiing, and it was a ski accident that I had just taking a bag out of the back of a car. Threw my back out skiing down a glacier, have a cataract in my left eye, have a mild hernia, have tingling in my left shoulder that they say is something to do with a pinched vertebra that might be old whiplash injury. And, you know, if I went through the whole body, it's the landscape of coming into age.
Well, Spalding Gray, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on again, Terry.
Spalding Gray, his monologue, Gray's Anatomy, is also published as a paperback book. He'll perform the monologue again in early November in Sewanee, Tennessee and Wilmington, Delaware. Next Monday on Martha's Vineyard, he'll perform his show, Gray on Gray. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.